Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hello and welcome to Your Booked. This episode, we're proud to be sponsored by Curzon Home Cinemas and the brand new film, Nonfiction, a comedy about the publishing industry, starring Juliette Binoche. If you love reading, you'll love watching this, and we'll have more details about that in the middle of the show. For now, I'm Daisy Buchanan, your book inspector and the author of The Sisterhood, a love letter to the women who shape me. Firstly, I'm thrilled to tell you that one of my all-time favourite writers has a brand new book coming out soon. It's a fabulously funny poetry book, Painfully British Haikus by Dale Shaw. Yep, that is our very own producer Dale, published by Michael Joseph. It's coming on the 14th of November and it's now available for pre-order. You can enjoy pieces like bunting. Bunting indicates something fun is taking place, but nothing too fun. It's a time when everything about being British can feel excruciatingly painful, so let the jokes soothe the hurt away. I think this is also perfect for awkward Christmas dinner conversations, when that uncle starts to make that xenophobic speech. Whip out your haikus and let the laughter begin! This week's guest is, I suspect, the person everyone would love to have around their Christmas dinner table, the historian, broadcaster and author, Professor Kate Williams. Kate is a professor of history at the University of Reading. She's a New York Times bestseller and she's got something exciting to say about everything from ancient Asian literature to the latest news about Harry and Meghan. This episode was recorded live at Henley Literature Festival. Henley Litfest is one of my favourite places and events, and I'd like to give a special shout out to the fabulous Bell Bookshop. It's one of my favourite indies with some of the best booksellers around, so if you're in Henley, go say hello, give them a wave, spend lots of money. Now here's Kate. Hello and welcome to Your Booked, the podcast for literary nosy Parkers. I'm Daisy Buchanan, your book inspector, and my very special guest is Professor Kate Williams. I'm sure you're all here for Kate. Could you do an Ellen one? Turn around and do it.
Yeah, do a selfie of us two. Should we do that? Okay, let's do it. Let's do a selfie of us and everyone behind us.
Live, on the podcast, you can hear a live selfie. Can we get everybody in?
I think if we crouch and everyone waves, yeah. I think we've got everyone. Oh, there we are. We're higher. Yeah, I reckon we've got it. Yeah,
it's got my forehead. Hey.
That wasn't.
Yeah. Now, I know you're all here for Kate, and I'm sure you're very well acquainted with her work, but she is a broadcaster, historian, and author, and an avid reader. So usually this podcast will take place in our guests' homes beside their bookshelves. So, Kate, I'm going to ask you to paint us a picture. We were in the room of books or a room where books are in your house at the moment, where would we be and what could we see?
Well, of course, this is my home, this wonderful paneled wooden room, and next door to the mayor's dressing room. This is all my home.
Is that one of your relatives?
Oh, yes, it is. Yes, the Queen. That's my one of my relatives. And, you know, these are my watercolours on the wall. Well, I'm just so thrilled to be on podcast. I'm such a huge fan of the podcast. She's such a huge fan of Daisy. And, you know, I was also just asking her why on Twitter she's not Roller Girl, and I've learned that. So that's everything. So I'm really excited to be here. And yes, I'm a very keen reader. So I have... Well, the house has got books everywhere. They're just everywhere. It's just terrible. And indeed, we live in a house now, but I used to have a flat. And when I was trying to sell it, the estate agent just said to me, all these have got to go. All these have got to go. All my bookshelves. He said that you replace them with small pots of potpourri, otherwise this place is not going to sell. So I took all the books off, gave them to my parents, bung them in my parents' house, and put boxes of potpourri on the bookshelves. But at the moment, it's not trying to sell it. So downstairs in the sitting room, I have my desk, and there's books behind me, lots of ones I'm reading at the moment, lots of ones I'm using my current book. Copies of my own books on shelves, and all the foreign editions. That's so 9 books and different editions and on the shelves. And then I've got some in the bedroom as well, quite a lot in there, some of my old favourites. And then upstairs we have a room which is supposed to be the guest room, which I'm glad that you can't see a picture of it, because the guests can barely get in. There's books on the bookshelves and piles of books everywhere all around the room. And we've had clear outs and it's just getting worse. So there's just books everywhere. And I am guilty of that terrible thing of, I'm sure you're all too organised for this, ladies and gentlemen, of buying a double of a book I already have because I can't find it. So yes, I used to have a very organised system, but now we've just got them everywhere. But I just can't stop, and then I just keep buying them and reading them and buying more books and going to the library, and I just can't stop.
You're an addict, but it's okay.
Yes,
this is a safe space.
I'm an addict.
Something that I loved reading was a piece you wrote about the stash of filthy books in the British Library. And lots of our guests have a particular book they read as a teen or a preteen that was something that was hidden from parents or teachers or passed around at school. Was there anything like that that defined your early reading life?
My early reading life, yes, I think we did pass around sort of Jackie Collins when I was younger and sort of stashed them between us. Yes, I think they were, but of course, you know, no one ever read, you know, Jackie's a great writer. We never read the book. It was just short sections.
Someone
would steal from someone's mum's bookshelf or something. Yes. Yes, it was, and of course, you know, Judy Blume was a terrible, great, you know, such a huge author for, you know, Forever. We all read Forever and Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret, and these wonderful books. But you know, I can remember the first book I read, or at least the first book that had an impact on me, and that was when I was at nursery school. So I think I must have been about 3 or something. I mean, obviously, it wasn't reading, but it was a picture book, and it was about this ant, and it's always stayed with me. You read these fascinating books about how to write a novel, you know, the initiating instant and how all the rest of it, and I think it had it all, and it was about this ant. And the first picture showed the ant walking along in the forest. Second picture showed the ant discovering a giant apple. And the third picture shows the ant deciding to invite all its friends to an ant banquet. And the ant goes and really prepares and goes and gets cutlery and napkins and all the rest of it and organises everything. And then when the poor ant goes back to the apple, its chums have all eaten it anyway.
Oh, no!
I know. It was the most heartbreaking story. I mean, honestly, you know, I know that there's...
I mean, that's a Laurie Moore book.
It was amazing. I mean, I can't... I should tweet, actually, and say, anyone remember this book? And I just remember this at nursery, and I was just... I've never forgotten it, and I'm not quite sure. It might be my first memory. I've got a memory of my mum being pregnant, and I think that was slightly later. So I think this could be my first memory, is reading the ant book. And I was so heartbroken on account of the ant, you know.
And was that the end? There was no happy ending for the ant.
No, that was it.
The apple's gone salt.
The ant was just looking at the apple core.
I can feel my eyes prickling.
It's, I mean, I maybe I have inherited that because if anyone who knows me, I'm always eating an apple and I don't wait, so maybe that's it. See what I eat it. Yes, but I was heartbroken for the poor ant.
So as a novelist, this very pure form of storytelling where there is not necessarily a happy ending, it's been distilled.
Yes, I mean, where's that happy ending? So that I can really remember, and I was a keen book lover as a child. I love so many, books.
I understand that the opposite of the ant was when you were studying for your PhD, that you tried to read the longest book written in every language.
Yes, well, I did. That was my mission as a PhD student. I don't think I read as much as I could have done as an undergraduate. I don't know. I found a quite difficult period. I think I think now there's lots of amazing YA, but I think when I was younger, there was a period for me when I was sort of, kind of 15 to 18, in which, you're too old for children's books, but you're too young for real adult books. Mm. Yes, you understand the language, but things like Jane Austen, well, truly, truly searingly brilliant, but for a 17-year-old, do you really understand the whole case of collaboration, sort of compromise, and the fact that, that Jane Austen, as a teenager, I was as idealistic as all teenagers are. And I don't think I read as much as I should have done as an undergraduate. But then on my year off in a postgrad, I read a lot. And then as a PhD student, I decided I was going to read the longest books in every language in translation. So I read Clarissa. I think it's arguable what is the longest one in English, but I think Clarissa is a big one.
I did an English degree, just a BA. I know nothing about Clarissa than the fact that it's a lot of bloody
words.
Long.
I think it's a million words in Clarissa, and my copy by the end was ripped into three parts. But I do.
So what's love it about? It. What happens?
What's it about? It is about Richardson's Clarissa. So Richardson writes his first book, Pamela, about a servant girl who the master, it's all very Me Too, the master tries to assault her. She won't have it. She keeps resisting him and standing up for herself, and eventually he marries her. And then Richardson writes a very boring sequel, Pamela 2, in which it's all about their happy marriage. And and then there's a possible interloper, and it's very dull.
Recipe for a happy marriage there, I can see.
I think Richardson got very... Pamela was a sensation. It was a book sensation. There were every type of Pamela souvenir was produced. Fans, dresses, outfits. It's incredible. And Richardson, I think, wanted to really show people what would happen with a rake reformed. Mm. That it couldn't, and he argued against all these people saying, oh, I can reform rakes. So Clarissa is about a young girl, a young upper middle class heiress who is basically abducted by a aristocrat and assaulted by him. The letter that Clarissa writes after this, called Paper X, is a truly brilliant piece of writing. And the first third is whether or not she's going to be abducted. The second third, this is 250,000 words, 300,000 words, sorry, I can't add up. 300,000 words is about, what him imprisoning her and what's going to happen. And then the third, I don't know if this is a spoiler here, but the final third is her dying. So, yes, and she dies. And of course, but the thing was that Richardson, he was a printer, so he could print his own book. And unfortunately, as one finds as a writer, readers don't always read your book in the way you thought they might. And most of us have to put up with it, but Richardson kept rewriting it to try and get the response he wanted. So initially, people were sympathetic to the aristocrat, the Lovelace, the kidnapper, and not so much to Clarissa. So he kept rewriting the book to make him badder and badder and badder, and so they could stop him. People writing to him, I love Lovelace, I want him.
I'm quite jealous of him. Are you to have that? To get the critical response and say,
I'm afraid that everyone just ignores the seven other. I think it's seven. The seven editions of Clarissa, and just the first one's the only one that matters. It's like Henry James, who rewrites all his books, and they aren't better the second time around. The first four versions are second better. So
is it Sarah Wall, who, moving way back to the 21st century, on Twitter was talking about how she writes a whole first draft and then, not Sarah Wall, she wrote Ghost Wall. What's her last name?
Sarah Moss.
Sarah Moss, thank you. As I said, Sarah Wall. I'm
long list for the Women's Prize, which I chaired. Wonderful book. Wonderful.
Very excited to ask you about that. But this is a great time to segue, actually, that she deletes her first draft and just writes it again from memory. Anyone else wanting to clutch the side of their
chairs?
Brave
woman. No. I just live in computer failure. But she's a wonderful writer. Fantastic book.
So,
but short. I'm they're very bad at writing short books, so I envy her.
Sort of the opposite of Richardson.
These long books. Yes, and there's so many great long books. There's a great one. You just have to repace yourself. There was a great one in Chinese, translated, of course. Story of the Stone. And I was just saying...
This is in your PhD, not the Booker Prize.
This is my...
Sorry, not the Booker Prize, the Women's Prize.
This is my fun reading, not the PhD. And and you just have to pace yourself, because obviously you're used to something happening in the first chapter or so, but with a multi-volume novel, it happens after the first volume. And there's a great one, in a great Japanese one. I don't know if anyone's read it, Tale of Genji, and it's fascinating because... So this 11th century Japanese writer, Lady Murasaki, and it's vital. And like so many other women writers from the past, she hasn't been forgotten. And this is because at the time, only women wrote in Japanese because it was seen as the lower language. Men wrote in Chinese, and that was the language of the court and the language of everything, of education. And women, of course, had no access to that because they're excluded because... second-class citizens. So she wrote in Japanese this wonderful novel about a heartthrob who just sort of seduces his way through the court. And unlike so many women who have forgotten, she's remembered because when every Japanese every person I've ever met who's been through the Japanese education system has read this book because it's so crucial. When we're thinking about literature, we want to go right back and find a founding father. But, of course, she's their founding mother because the people at the time, the great male writers, were writing not in the Japanese language. So she's a fascinating story.
I find that really thrilling that people will make culture and make art and produce no matter how things are stacked against them. There's a book, I think, about the habits of writers and... There are lots of men mentioned who, they will write between 10 and 6 and like, darling, keep the children away, I must write in silence. And then women, it was just scribbling in books and, pushing notebooks under cushions and no one really taking it seriously. It's like, oh, you're writing little stories, are you? Okay, I'm going to come blather on or make you make a meal for me. And I think it is just so interesting, isn't it, that it sort of, no matter what obstacles are there, it bubbles up.
Yes,
maybe sometimes it bubbles up more,
yes,
the harder it is.
Yes. Well, we think of Austin, of course. Was surrounded by people the whole time, and yet writes the greatest books. And you think of greatest books in the language, and you think of George Eliot, who was apparently was busily reading German philosophy at the same time as making bread.
Multitasking. I don't know if that's inspiring or depressing.
Yeah.
I'm going to skip into the future again and ask you about the Women's Prize. What is that experience like? How much of the long list do you have to read? Or do you have to stay away from the books until...
Oh, no. So I read all of them. I read, it's about 150. And it's your job to call in any books that you think have been missed as well, haven't been submitted. So it's a lot of books, but it's wonderful. I mean,
when has that come up?
Which
books have you landed on and said, I think we need to consider this?
Well, because obviously publishers can only submit... so many books, and so there are maybe books that don't get
of course
submitted.
Are there any particular titles that you have thought of and that we
yeah
must
but
get
I don't think I should say because oh, I don't because I don't because I don't think I should say which so the authors might not know
can you say what they write
submitted.
With oh that's true
but yes I did call in quite a few and that hadn't been submitted by publishers.
I mean that must be such a thrill for an author though to know that there's someone out there looking out for them.
Yeah, but I think I saw it as the job of the chair. It's a job to keep up with all the publishing.
I mean, broadly, what are the long list titles that have really stayed with you over the years?
Of all the women's prize. Mm,
as long as you've been involved with it.
Goodness. Well, I was only chair 1 year. So I only chaired it last year, and the rest of the year I've just been a hobbyist who just reads for fun.
Because it's
you only chair 1 year, and then you. So as chair, I've chaired the Costa Book Award as well, you're more dealing with the shortlist, but this one, it was about dealing with all the books and looking at them all, then getting a long list, then getting a short list, then getting a winner. And obviously had marvellous, you know, wonderful judges, Leila Hussein and Sarah Wood and Arifa Akbar and Dolly Alderton, you know, fantastic judges. It was a really wonderful experience. And women's fiction, you know, it's truly fantastic. So it was such a great honour to read these wonderful, amazing books. And, you know, and I think as an author, you know how much it means. Mm. I mean, if I was to be long-listed for the Women's Prize, I think I would die. And someone did actually, you know, quite a few people were tweeting, this is the best day of my life. And you think, and I said...
I mean, surely you could have just sort of put on a moustache and a hat and said, have you thought about Kate's book? I think it's very good.
Could have done.
Next time.
Could have done.
Now you know where they meet next year. You can just sort of pop around the back. Yeah. Just leave this here, put it in the pile.
Well, obviously, there's some bumper things for next year. Wonderful books. I mean, Margaret Atwood's The Testaments. I mean, you know, Elif Shafak, you know, he's on the Book Prize. The Book Prize is 10 minutes and 38 seconds. And we've also got Duck's New Report. So there's a lot of great books for the Women's Prize next year. So I, you know, don't envy those judges. There's some fantastic books.
The Booker shortlist is so good. And
it's
so
wonderful.
Eclectic. And I do also, I just after, it was intense. I read Duck's New Report, the book that is 1,000 pages and one sentence long. And I loved it. And I loved the challenge of, you know, really having to kind of raise my reading game and flex a muscle and sort of, you know, endure. So it's weird because it was sort of meditative and anxiety inducing. But I think that's interesting that, you know, now I think it must be a very disciplined reader to read the things, the length and breadth that you have. Do you think that as readers we ought to raise our game a little bit? Do you think that modern reading can be lazy reading?
I mean, I am a wild book addict. You know, I'll probably be, you know, I'll be shot because I'll be reading a book. It'll happen. Something because I won't be looking. And so I'm a wild book addict, and wouldn't say I'm.
So you get a really big book and think, great, loads of book. This will keep me going for some time.
I do love a big book, I completely love to read, and I am addicted. And I'm interested by a lot of authors who say to me they don't read while they're writing because they don't want their style to be infected. And I'm afraid I'm just so addicted, and I love books so much that I can't stop.
How do you sort of negotiate that boundary between reading for pleasure and reading for work? Because you must be reading whenever you're awake.
Yeah, so well, it does blur. Some, you know, often you read, if I'm doing historical research, I read a wonderful book from the 16th century that is absolutely fantastic and gripping, and then you read a modern book as well. And I think, you know, there's so much imagination. It's just so wonderful to be transported in someone else's imagination just for a little while.
If you could go back, because I, you know, historically the sort of the periods you cover, but you're an expert in many, many areas, but do you have a particular period that you love or a period that you'd love to just take a year and really focus on?
Well, my most recent book is about Mary Queen of Scots, about the 16th century, which I absolutely love, and it's a wonderful, fascinating, amazing period, and so gripping for queenship. Mary Queen of Scots is so frequently seen as a failed queen, is a tragic queen, but if you look at her in terms of queenship, she did everything that monarchs like Elizabeth I did and were congratulated for, listening to their ministers, introducing religious toleration. But unfortunately, Elizabeth I, if she's undermined by her ministers, it just means that they don't invite her to meetings, and they sort of try and leave her out of conversations, but Mary they try and kidnap. So it's a distinction. And so that was my most recent one. But I
I'm currently trying to write a book, which is very behind. It's really behind. About the 18th century publishing industry and about some of the unknown women writers. Well, they are not unknown, but the women writers who have been left out of our canon then. So I'm deep in that at the moment.
So yeah. I'd love to ask you about that, but not if it's going to cause you anguish and trauma. Can we talk any more about the 18th century?
Yes, well, it was a time of... This is just before Richardson, really. This is a time when suddenly publishing becomes an explosion of business. And the printing press obviously was old, but the commercialization of it really begins at this point, the early 18th century, post-industrial revolution.
Addison and Lee and the coffee shop.
The coffee shop and the magazines and the tattle. Absolutely, yeah, you paid lots of attention to your English degree.
That's one seminar I went to.
Yeah, yeah. But then these women authors... You know, Eliza Haywood, she wrote dozens and dozens, of books, including a book about Mary, Queen of Scots. We've just really forgotten about her. And she's studied in postgraduate courses, particularly in the US, but just not really here. So, and she's an amazing, she earned her money by her pen, and she writes this sort of, they're some early bong busters. They're pretty wild. And then she gets very moral later on, post-Richardson, and writes very moralistic ones. And I'm fascinated by these early female writers and the force of their imagination.
Tell us more about these bong busters.
Well, there tends to be a handsome count and an innocent young girl. And the handsome count keeps trying to take advantage of the innocent young girl, but then something happens, like a servant enters or a door enters and he can't, and that happens quite a lot. And then finally he realises he shouldn't be taking advantage of her and they get married and they're happily ever after. That's the basic template.
So,
or sometimes it's like the ant. Sometimes I'm afraid he eats her up and leaves the apple core.
She's ready.
That's it.
So we need to find the 18th century term for cock blocking.
Count blocking. I talked a little bit about Eliza Haywood, Latitude Festival with Scarlett Curtis, and she said she's the ultimate cock blocker. And so she said it and you've said it. So I basically think I've got the blurb now for my book about Eliza Haywood, the ultimate cock blocker. This is the cock blocker, says Daisy Buchanan and Scarlett Curtis. So I've got it. So
you can have that for the cover, with my blessing.
Well, that's the I did teach creative writing. I just teach history at the moment. You know that in all these fascinating books like Save the Cat, it's about what does your character want and how do you keep stopping them? So Eliza Haywood makes them very clear what the count wants and how he keeps being stopped.
Save the Cat. That's a screenwriting book, right?
It's a screenwriting book, yes, and there's also a Save the Cat writes a novel as well.
Oh.
So the principle is that your hero or heroine will do something like save the cat early on and prove that they are someone who is likable. I've never saved a cat, so I'm clearly not likable at all. I'd love to, but I never see anyone need saving.
There is still time.
I've never seen a cat
at home, we can have a short recess.
Yeah.
Kate will save it
for you. I'll save the cat.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
We'll be back to Kate soon, but now it's time for my Steal of the Week. And this week, it's not a book, it's a film about books. We love non-fiction, starring Juliette Binoche, which is out in selected cinemas on Friday, October the 18th, which is this coming Friday, if you're listening the week this episode drops on a Monday. And it will be available on Curzon Home Cinema 2. Non-fiction is all about Leonard, a successful bohemian novelist, and Alain, the old friend and literary editor who riles Leonard when he turns down his latest manuscript. Alain might be out of his depths when he hires and falls for the gorgeous Laure, but unbeknownst to him, Leonard has been getting to know Alain's wife, Selina, a little too well. Non-fiction is chic, charming, and extremely funny. It's a real treat for anyone who wants to be nosy about the publishing industry and the digital world. If you're a fan of Call My Agent on Netflix, I'm obsessed. I think you'll adore it. Of course, the only thing better than a great film might be a great film that you don't have to leave your house to watch. Curzon Home Cinema is an on-demand platform where you can watch Curzon releases the same day they're released into cinemas. Curzon believe that cinema should be accessible for everyone, so they're passionate about giving consumers the chance to pick where they watch films. Head to curzonhomecinema.com for more information and curzoncinemas.com for a list of showtimes if you do feel like venturing outside when you watch non-fiction. Now, back to Kate.
I guess what we want as readers probably hasn't really changed that much over several hundred years. It's the same kind of being titillated and being rewarded.
I agree. I think rewarded. I think the rewards of plot. I think the rewards of story, the rewards of character. And this was really the beginning of the novels, so they really were the very earliest of novels. And as you say, they are. We still see the same now. The love story doesn't work out, or the and there were. They had the basic seduction plot got combined by other authors. So one of them combined them with adventure stories and lustful Turks who kept popping up. Ooh. There's a lustful Turk. The other one combined them with the count character would keep lecturing the heroine before he seduced her with lengthy lectures. That was the other one. And the other one, the other author combined these seduction plots with religion and had a lot of erotic death scenes. Which is one of my favourite chapters in my book about erotic death scenes. I think that, that's my good subtitle. So what
is an erotic death scene? Was it like, oh, it's okay if they have sex because the message here is sex kills?
It's a kind of mixture. You know when you go to Rome and you see those wonderful statues of saints in ecstasy that don't seem to get too far from other types of ecstasy. So it's when Harry met Sally type ecstasy at the same time as Jesus. So that's you get these combinations of sort of women. Am I going too far at Henley Literature to go to this? But women who are about to die having these astonishing moments of ecstasy with Jesus just before they die. So kind of truly erotic final death moments. Yeah, so basically, now this isn't going too far, but basically pre-death orgasms. That was key part.
What a way to go!
So quite a lot of them. That was very popular in the 18th century. I mean, I don't know whether you think, ladies and gentlemen, whether I could bring it back as a genre. You know, it was a bestseller there, could it be now?
Popular in literature or just popular?
Literature certainly. Whether or not it was a consoling idea that they all joined in with, but I think the movement between spiritual ecstasy and count stimulated ecstasy was not too far apart, but you see it in the basic love stories that it's almost like semi. The language of a seduction story is so often using the language of religion. Their bodies are elevated. It's transcendent. So,
things sort of heaving, inflated,
early form of transubstantiation. Yeah, all that sort of stuff. Yeah,
it's really, really fascinating.
Yes.
Because I know we've
talked... We'll keep erotic death scenes from the podcast, yes.
I think that might be a whole separate podcast, yes, erotic death scenes.
Yes.
I know we've talked about all kinds of erotica in the British Library, which we might come back to, but I know you are, you know, a very big advocate of the British Library, but what was your relationship with libraries growing up? Was there a library that you particularly loved or visited often?
Well, I engaged my mother in an act of fraud because I grew up in the Midlands and there were two libraries. There was the Stourbridge Library and there was the Kinver Library, and we lived in between in a small village, and I was at school in Kinver. But really, then we joined, I got my mother to join both using our postcode. So we lived in Kinver, but we had a Stourbridge postcode. Therefore, I qualified for both libraries, and therefore I went to both, and that was completely fraudulent. And my mother had to overlook this. So we got, so that meant I got out about 11 books a week, which was absolutely marvellous. And they were my favourite times to get out the books.
And enough to keep you going.
Yes, exactly. So I was a library addict, I really was. I try to remember. There's the one about a girl going to the seaside with her older cousins called The Visitors, I think, that I keep trying to think about. And maybe I should tweet and ask what
it was. The Visitors?
Yes.
Sounds like it's not Lynn Reed Banks, is it?
Oh, I don't know. I have to look it up.
It sounds a bit like the Family from One End Street books.
Oh, that's their wonderful, aren't they?
I loved.
Yes.
I think there's lots
Mrs.
of
Muggles.
Getting out of the...
Yeah, they're wonderful.
East London.
Kate loses her hat.
Is that as a Kate, was that especially traumatic for you?
Well, I love the Family at One End Street, and I loved books about magic, and I love Diana Wynne Jones, I adored Crestomancy, and I love Pollyanna, and I love Mrs. Frisbee and The Rats of Nim was another favourite of mine. You know, there's a story I tell. I was so desperate when I was a little girl to a world of imagination. You know, the Midlands is a wonderful place. We live in a dormitory village outside, you know, a very nice place. But I wanted more kind of old stuff and imagination. And I made a time machine when I was about seven, and out of a cardboard box that the washing machine had come in.
Oh,
and
excellent.
And covered it in pipe cleaners and stickers and that sort of thing. And made this time machine and wrote time machine on the front.
Because that's what makes it work.
Yeah, that's what makes it work. And then I put my brother into it, who was about five. So I put him into the box. And then I take him on journeys. I said, oh, wow, Jeff. My little brother's called Jeff. Oh, wow, you know, we're going travelling, going to Egypt. Oh, look at the pyramids, look at Tutankhamun. And now we're going to Henry VIII's court. And, of course, Jeff, age five, would say, let me out. I want to get out. And I say, no, Jeff, you can't get out. You must not get out, because then you'll be stuck in Egypt and you will never return to 1980s Wolverhampton. You can't go back. And after a while...
It's like, yes, I know, let me out.
Yeah, I'll stay in Egypt. But after a while, Jeff, of course, got weary of being put in the box. And then I got in the box myself because I bought my own hype and tried to go travelling, but I never went anywhere. And now I think that's what I love about reading so much, is that I get my own time machine. I get to write them myself and create my own time machine. And I have to say, I'm better with words than I was ever with pipe cleaners. And and I get to, you know, read other people's. And I just think it's such an amazing privilege to read all these wonderful books and to live in, you know, part of the world where there's no censorship and we can read the books we want to read.
I love that. What is the last novel that transported you that way, when you looked up and you really were shocked to realise you were in your world and not theirs?
Oh, well, I did love Elif Shafak's 10 Minutes, 38 Seconds in Our Strange World. I thought that was a mark on the Book of Horrors shortlist. I thought it was a wonderful book. And, you know, about this sex worker who was found who is dying in a bin in Istanbul, and it goes through all her memories of her life and how she's got there and how she's arrived there, and I found it completely mesmerising. I read it in... I read a lot of books in one go. Yeah, I have a very tolerant family, but I couldn't put it down. Absolutely gripping.
It's extraordinary. What I love so much about Elif's writing is She is so masterful in the way that she sort of conjures senses. You can feel like the air on your skin in the way that that character does. And you can
she's amazing.
Hear and smell. And it's such a, it's almost claustrophobic, but in a great way.
Yeah. It was such a wonderful book. So, yes, I love to be transported. And I really do. I think it's an amazing book. And I'm currently on a mission as well at the moment to try and read all of Agatha Christie, and I've been tweeting about this. I don't know about you, ladies and gentlemen, but I can never get the murderer, ever. And I got a murder is easy. I did, and even though I've read it before, I've read the Caribbean Mystery before, and I did it again and still got it wrong. And even though I know that it's the least likely person, I get the wrong least likely person. And murder is easy. I did get it, but everyone else, I don't know, anyone, can you get the murderer? No? Anyone? Yeah. No? Yeah, you can. So, I bet Daisy can.
No, I'm same as you. I'm like, if there's a minor character that's come in for half a page, two chapters
in. Oh, it's the gardener,
Like, oh, yes, that would make sense. It must have been them.
I confront my own failure every day because I know that lots of people on Twitter tell me that they get it straight away. And I just, Agatha Christie bamboozles me every time.
But isn't it fun not knowing, having that? Because are you surprised? Every time, because I think that's,
I am surprised
again,
every time. I love to be.
A
I love surprise.
Kind of reward, I suppose.
I love surprise. You know, my PhD examiner, she's a marvelous scholar, Ros Ballister, and she said to me that shows how disciplined she is about disciplined reading. You know what she does? She said to me that she reads the end of a book first, so she's not reading for the plot. So she can read for the themes and the characters. Mm. And every day I think I need to be like her because I love reading for the plot. I love it. I just get completely gripped and caught up in the plot. And even though I just can't stop.
I don't know how I feel about that. I think I'm much more tempted to do it in a book where I'm sort of struggling a bit so I can sort of relax. Because sometimes it's more, if I don't care so much about what's happening, then it's harder for me to sort of have that as a reason to read. I think that's something that people often get confused about with romantic comedies as well, when people are very dismissive about those books. And they're like, well, it's so obvious, what's going to happen? And I'm like, well, yes, that's the thing, that's what's so satisfying. And I think, you know, possibly the same for lots of people, for crime, for Agatha Christie. It's that what is obvious, but how is fascinating.
Absolutely. How did that gardener do it? Even if he didn't get the right character.
Do you have any literary crushes, counts notwithstanding, or any people in books that you admire or fancy?
I love the Brontes. I love everything about the Brontes. I love Emily and Charlotte. So Emily Bronte was my mastermind subject. They said, oh, what do you want to do mastermind on? And I said, oh, I'll do it on one of my books, like Emma Hamilton. They said, oh, no, you can't do it on one of your books. So, yes. And then I asked for Austen, and they said that was gone, and Dickens had been done. I think George Eliot had been done, and Charlotte Bronte had been done. And then I thought, Emily Bronte? And so I did Emily Bronte as my mastermind subject, and won mastermind, got the trophy. Unfortunately, my mastermind trophy, it's a bit of a tragedy, really. It was used by a visiting small chum against my pointless trophy. She bopped them together, and the pointless trophy got a bit chipped. So, but the mastermind trophy is still there. I love Emily, and I love Charlotte, and I love the Brontes.
That's quite good to know about the robustness of various game shows. In Top Trumps, Mastermind beats all.
Well, you know, I was a bit...
I was very excited about your pointless victory. I was very impressed by that.
Now, if they ever invite me back, I've got to win, you know, because I've broken my trophy. And I love the Brontes. I'm such an admirer of them and their efforts
to work.
What
is it about the Brontes and about Emily that you really respond to? At what point in your life did you sort of meet them?
I think I was really very young. I mean, I read Jane Eyre when I was really far too young, I think, 12 or 13, I think.
See, I don't know, because I think Jane Eyre is almost classic YA, because it's so intense. And when you're like 12 oh, yes. and no one understands
Mrs.
me.
Reed, yes.
It's perfect. It's when you need it
so
to come into your life.
So wonderful. And I think when you go to the parsonage, it's so wonderful to see where they all were and the small house, and they were all ill, and they had their ne'er-do-well brother, and there they are creating these incredible works of literature. And whenever I'm too lazy to write, I think, yeah, but the Brontes would have done. Yeah.
It's something that I don't feel as though we talk about enough, that their world was so tiny and they imagined
but their imagination was so great.
Where did that come from? You know, they knew, like, they didn't know anyone who wasn't related to them, really, and yet they magicked all this up.
And I think what is amazing about the Brontes is that how they're imaginative right from the early stages, and you look at their early worlds that they created, like Gondal. I mean, they're amazing. These teenage worlds that they created, sort of slight role-playing, slight imaginative worlds that they were creating between them. I mean, and these are completely imagined worlds, and how they do that, I think it's absolutely amazing. I think that they are, and this imagination, and then they take it away from the fantasy world and into sort of these novels that are, well, realistic, but still are fantasy, and just incredible.
I do not want to get too political here, but I can understand that there's a logic to art flourishing during times when the real world is a bit much and you want to escape. So I'm hoping that, you know, some good may come of what's about to come in that sense.
Yes, I agree with you.
We're all going to live in remote parsonages and with our insufficient food and imagine things like the Brontes.
Yes, exactly.
I'm going to be boring and ask you about more fiction, which I know you've got a lot on. So the current book, this is non-fiction.
Yes,
that you're...
I am trying to write another novel. So I've written five history books. There's Emma Hamilton, Queen Victoria, Empress Josephine, Elizabeth II, and Mary Queen of Scots most recently. And I've written four novels. So the first one was The Pleasures of Men. And if you Google that, you get all kinds of results.
Safe
search. You know, Estée Lauder's Pleasures of Men is about the only and my book, obviously, the only appropriate one. That was about Victorian murder. And I think, obviously, authors don't tend to love Amazon reviews for so many reasons, because, you know, especially when you get one that says, yeah, no marks because the packaging was bad. You're like, thanks.
Was late.
Yeah, no marks because it wasn't prime. Yes, exactly. And then I got one on Amazon that said, I've seen Kate Williams on the TV, and she seems like such a nice person on TV. But after reading this book, if I saw her coming towards me in the street, I would cross over to get away from her because of my crazy warped mind. And I tell you, ladies and gentlemen, I'm a very safe person. You know, children, cats, safe with me. But that was my first one, Victorian Murder. And then I wrote a trilogy.
I mean, if it was me, I would get that. I'd get someone to make that into a cross stitch and I'd hang it above my bed. There would be
my favourite blurb. Yeah, I cross over to avoid Kate Williams. She's not as nice as she seems on those programmes. And then... then I wrote a trilogy, Storms of War, Edge of the Fall, Storms of War about 1940, about the Great War, Edge of the Fall about the family in the 1920s.
And that's what I find so interesting, that you can sort of, you know, there's such an Edouard
a trilogy,
moving
yeah.
from, you
it's
know,
it's
the
interesting
sort of the
writing a trilogy because
16th
you know, you
century,
have to,
but also right into the 20th century.
I'm always in my time machine. Yeah, it's really interesting writing a trilogy because you just have to realise when you write a standalone, you just write it. Mm. And when you write a trilogy, you have to make sure that you are going to have some characters to do something in the future.
Did you always know it was going to be a trilogy?
Yes. So I do have friends who write trilogies more frequently than I do, who write them all out in one go, like 300,000 words in one go, and then split them up. And so they know that they have the characters.
Richardson style.
Yeah, all the words. But I didn't do that. But luckily, I did have enough characters to... be placed in important situations in the 20s and the 30s. So I did that and then the 30s, and now I'm writing a new novel, which is very early stages, which is about the Empire. So that's very early stages, and I'm thinking about a comic YA novel as well.
Victorian times.
India and the Empire in the Victorian times. So that's very early stages. So
comic YA, yes. Though, that sounds brilliant.
Comic YA, but I write.
That contemporary or is that?
It is contemporary. That's modern. Yes.
Obviously. Oh, that sounds great. But how much can you tell us, if anything?
Not very much. Yeah, not very much.
I've said too much.
But it's amazing. It's I write my history books because I do the research and then I type. You know, you should use a computer in the archive or occasionally a notebook, and then type it up and work. Very occasionally, I write history books by hand, but usually I'm using a computer to write my history books. But with the novels, I write a lot of it by hand, and I have very bad handwriting. So there's two problems with my notebooks. Is number one, it's a hostage to fortune. You're like, oh, don't let me lose this on the train to Reading. And also, sometimes I look back and can't read my handwriting as to what I've written. So maybe I'm a bit like Sarah, because I can't actually read my first draft. But I find writing by hand incredibly liberating. And I wrote The Pleasures of Men, my first novel. I wrote it wasn't my first novel to be written. It was my first novel to be published. You know,
yes.
That's what it often is. Isn't it?
There's a distinction.
There were other ones that I just didn't feel had worked, but this one really overwhelmed me and absorbed me, and I couldn't stop writing it. But I wrote it by hand. I find there's something slightly more freeing about sometimes writing by hand, because writing on the computer automatically seems official, and writing by hand, you just think,
so
this is just me and my crazy, crazy mind.
Were you writing kind of anywhere and everywhere, and you'd just be thinking about
pretty
things?
Pretty frenzied.
And grab your notebook out of your bag.
Felt something
and
a bit
go.
with the novel. I'm writing my new novel in that in the kind of frenzied style. Yes,
frenzied style.
Yeah, I love it. I love to read and I love to write, and sometimes I'm. You know, my the world of my head and my writing, it's a world that sometimes is terrifying and worries me, but that sometimes it's a world that I want to get on the plane and go there every morning.
Always up for getting out of the washing machine box.
Yeah. We need a new washing machine, actually, because ours is broken, so maybe I should make a new box.
Oh, yeah.
See if it works this time.
Get the pipe cleaners out.
Yeah, exactly. Get my old craft.
We're going to have some questions. Oh, over here. Hello.
Hello.
A microphone is coming to you.
Thank you. I'm just curious to understand how you move from your creative and wonderful mind to the discipline of filming and making documentaries. What kind of shift do you have to make mentally and creatively to do that?
Yes, I think you're quite right. I do have different things that I do. So I write history books, I write fiction books, I have my university job at the University of Reading, and I do TV, and I do TV documentaries, and I do TV news, and I do talks at festivals. So I have a kind of varied career, and I'm very grateful for it. I think I'm in, I don't think as a schoolgirl in Midlands I ever thought I'd be able to do this professionally, so I'm incredibly grateful for what I do. But I like the variety, actually. I do like the variety that sometimes, because obviously writing is a very lone endeavour until you give it to the publisher and suddenly, it's a different thing. But writing is a lone endeavour, and I think it's sometimes good to have the variety of going out and working with a documentary crew or writing your pieces to camera for the documentary. And so I think it's a really good discipline for me to vary it. And I think, although Antonia Fraser, who I had the incredible privilege of interviewing this morning, absolutely amazing. And
oh, yes, we didn't even get to that. Did anyone here go to that fabulous, excellent?
And we performed, did the world premiere of her play, Molly Stewart and Betsy Tudor, that she wrote the short play in which I was Elizabeth I and she was Mary Queen of Scots, and it was amazing. And I was blown away. And she, she said, that because obviously she had six children, that mothers don't have time for writer's block, and I think you know, I do have writer's block. I do. There are books that don't work, or books halfway through that don't work, or books I'm going very slowly on. But I do think that the fact is that there are some days in which I literally cannot write because I'm doing something else. I'm working with the students. I'm at the university, or I'm filming. So it's a good break for me, because then next morning you think, oh, I really want to get back to it. It does work well for me. And I obviously filming is a process that's so different, but I love the sort of creativity and expressiveness about it. And the research that I do informs the filming that I do, and I think they work together. So I
not to put words into your mouth, but I'm wondering whether, you know, when filming, there are so many people and so many practical things and so much sort of juggling to do, that whether you just really appreciate it when it can just be you and your notepad and just you and your computer.
I love them both. Yeah, and you know, and obviously, filming. I've just got a series about the Secrets of the Royals on Channel 5, and last week they made me eat a cockatrice, which in celebration of the Henry VIII's obsession with meat feasts, in which, you know, because the Tudors, they'd like to, like, you know, get a chicken and stuck it in a goose, and then stuck it in a sheep, and then stick it in a cow, and then cook the whole thing on a spit. And of course, it was
Little
disgusting.
Little are doing a Christmas special, $5.99.
Disgusting. Because it didn't really, obviously, you would think it wouldn't work, because every type of meat cooks a different time.
So is that's called a cockatrice?
No, that's what they did. But the cockatrice, we did a simpler version. That one's kind of like some giant rainbow cake of meat. And this one is when you get a cockatrice, the front is a pig and the back is a chicken, and you tie them together and cook them. And that's what I had to eat. Thanks, Channel 5.
Was it delicious?
No, not the slightest. Not the slightest, because of course the chicken, the pig cooks much slower than the chicken. And it looks so weird. And that was, because Henry VIII and, you know, the Tudors, the vegetables were really for the lower classes, so they had to eat meat and loads of it. And they had weird meat. I mean, they ate dolphin, but they liked to eat these crazy things. So they like, so their idea of fun is tying two animals together. I'm not sure it's come back yet. I don't know if it will. You know, head of a cow and back of a sheep. So I had to eat that. So then we went to the National Archives doing some wonderful things about the royal kitchens. And next week, I think it's Royal Doctors. And you know, they found an amazing document from Queen Victoria's. Queen Victoria's doctor, who all about her, what we call now postnatal psychosis. Absolutely mind-blowing.
So when can we watch this?
This is, I think Doctors I'm doing next week. I think it's a series at the moment on Channel 5.
It's being filmed. Broadcast now.
I've done it. So yes, because obviously Victoria, it was like, perfect, happy mother, perfect childhood, it's all marvellous, perfect life. And that was the image that was given to the nation and the empire, but behind it, Victoria has this incredible postnatal psychosis. It's amazing to read her doctor write about it. He says that Victoria, she sees the moles on people's faces at court and thinks they're holes that worms are coming out of.
Oh, my God.
She's become so obsessed with death, and she sees coffins going past. And that, of course, is completely antithetical to the vision we have of the young queen.
Yeah.
And perfect domesticity. And the doctor, that's an amazing source. So I love the research. So yes, I feel that, you know, the research is a great privilege, and the filming is a great privilege. And
you can hear it in your voice.
I'm lucky to be in the time machine every day. And I'm just you know, got this book to do. So I'm just hoping that there's no major royal events to come, because they're not going to spring anything on me, because you never know what they're going to spring on you.
Yes.
So I was busy with the Supreme Court last week. And its impact on the monarchy and what it means for the relationship between the Queen and Prime Minister. So I have to be ready for news as well, which I love.
So we can sort of, you know, if international events can just calm down for 6 months, yes, it'll be a bit of
the Queen
time.
Just doesn't spring anything on me.
I've got carried away then. I think we've got time for another question.
Hiya. Just thought, following on from that, when you are making your documentaries, is it always subject matters that you have come up with and kind of put to producers and a passion of your own? Or is it the other way around, in that you're approached about a certain subject matter and then you kind of go away and work on it? You know, how does that work?
Both happens. What I tend to find is that you know, things are very cyclical, is that I say I want to do something and pitch something and everyone says no to me, and then sort of 3 years later they come back saying, oh, we've got this idea. So it does tend to be both of them. Most of the ones I've done recently, they've all been something that I really wanted to do, which is really marvellous. And there are some things that I really want to get on TV that I still have failed at, and I hope I will eventually.
Can you tell us all that jinx it?
Well, I'd love to get a series on about female pirates. I think the female pirates
of
the 17th century and 18th century, like Anne Bonny.
Take my money.
Really fascinating, and whether or not I think Gráinne O'Malley is an incredible character. She's often seen as the Irish pirate queen, but she was a great landowner in Ireland. And Irish history is very much excluded from 16th century history. And she, Mary Queen of Scots, of course, was desperate for a meeting with Elizabeth I, never got it. But Gráinne did. She was allowed to take her own dagger in. She was allowed to take her own knife in with a meeting with Elizabeth I. Amazing. So she's an incredible character. I did this TV radio program called The Pitch, and they said, "What do you think would make a great movie?" And I said, "Gráinne should make a great movie." But they said, and their judgment, they judged them. The Radio 4 expert panel judged them, and they said, "Yes, it's a good idea. It's a good idea, but there's a lot of sea battle scenes." And I'd love to get a TV show off about female pirates. And if I could dress up and be on a pirate ship and that kind of thing. I think there are lots of things I'd love to be on TV. But I think viewership would love female pirates. I think they would. Yeah.
Excellent.
But it's wonderful. But of course, with news, I just respond to what happens. So I just go and hopefully I've got something to,
Everybody, go on the internet, Google some production companies. Hello, I was wondering if you'd consider making a documentary about female pirates.
Yeah.
Together we can make this happen.
The odd male can come in if they want. Yeah. We can have a few men.
I'm imagining them actually sort of coming in on a rope, like swinging, literally swashbuckling. I guess that's all the questions. Thank you so much for coming.
Huge thank you to Kate.
Let's give her another round of applause.
Huge thanks to Kate, and do tweet her at @KateWilliamsMe if you recognise her Ant book. Kate is a prolific writer and has written so many brilliant books, but I'd recommend starting with Rival Queens, The Betrayal of Mary, Queen of Scots, to find out a bit more about what she was talking about on this podcast. I'm Daisy Buchanan, and I've been your book inspector. Thank you so much for joining me, Shelf Obsessives. You can find me on Twitter at @NotRollerGirl and on Instagram at @TheDaisyBee. Say hello, suggest some guests, and watch out for shelfies. Visit our show page, acast.com/booked, for more information about our guests and a list of the books I've talked about. If you've got any other queries about the podcast, you can email us at whybooked@gmail.com. Your Book is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and hosted by Acast. Please do subscribe, rate us, and leave a review. It's great to hear what you think, and it helps other people to find the podcast. But now, I leave you with this from Virginia Woolf. This is an important book, the critic assumes, because it deals with war. This is an insignificant book because it deals with the feelings of women in a drawing room.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.